for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. A rise in consumer prices in July eases fears of deflation. A federal judge in California said same-sex marriages can resume next week, barring action by an appeals court. The House on Tuesday held a rare summer session to pass a $26 billion state aid bill that prevents the layoff of teachers and other public workers. And yesterday, the Senate approved a $600 million border security measure. Joining us for the domestic hour of our Friday News Roundup, John King of CNN, Jackie Combs of The New York Times, and Ron Elving of NPR. You, as always, are part of the program. I look forward to hearing from you. Call us on 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or Twitter. Quite a rainy week here in Washington, John King. Can you believe it?
It's been interesting, a little violent with the weather. Some of it's beautiful, but some of it's threatening.
Well, so how does the weather fit in with the economy, Ron Elving?
The other morning, I woke up and watched it get darker after I got up, which was an unusual experience. And I think we're having something of a similar experience with the economy. We all thought last spring that in some sense a corner had been turned. We'd had some quarters of consecutive growth. Things seemed to be looking up. The question was, how quickly will the jobless rate come down? And instead, we seem to have hit a stall somewhere around March, April, May. Some of it may have had to do with the debt crisis in Europe, people comparing us to Greece and Spain, who had very severe problems in their economies. And the positive psychology that was entering the market, that was certainly entering the body politic and people's consciousness, was reversed to some degree. And that has begun to produce a lot of talk about a double-dip recession, and even talking about a W-shaped recession, a double-dip recession where we go back down to negative growth, has really spooked a lot of people. It spooked investors. It spooked people thinking about buying something. It has produced talk in the markets that has brought back down the growth in the markets. So it's been a darkening sky.
Jackie.
And it's happening just politically speaking as voters' minds are starting to solidify about what they think about the performance of the president and the Democratic Congress, and that's not good news, as was reflected this week in the latest poll from the Wall Street Journal and NBC News, which was almost all bad news for the president and the Democrats. In turn, they've lost their advantage in voters' minds in how to handle the economy, taxes, the deficit, you know, all those things. And so it's really hard to see how in the remaining, you know, 2+ months before the election, how this could possibly be turned around.
John King, however, I think we have to say the president did get a health care bill through. He did get stimulus packages through. He did get an unemployment assistance measure through. And yet, reporters keep talking about the president in such negative terms. Why is that?
Well, in part, we talk about it that way because that's how voters are interpreting it. If you look at public opinion data or if you travel the country, the greatest frustration for this White House is they can legitimately say we have a long list of achievements, some things we campaigned on,
absolutely,
some things we had to do in response to, you know, crises or problems, but the American people don't see it as steps in the right direction. They don't see the stimulus bill as doing enough. Maybe some think it helped. Maybe some think it was a waste of money. There's a debate about that, but it's hard to find people who say it was enough. If you look at the fundamentals, Jackie just touched on some of them, 7 in 10 Americans think things are going badly in the country right now. And about 16 to 16.5%, that's 1 in 6 Americans are either unemployed or underemployed, meaning they have a part-time job and want a full-time job. In that kind of a funk, a president does not get credit even for the things he says, you know, I deserve credit for this one.
The only exception to that I can think of offhand, and it's only a partial exception, was that in the 1982 midterm election, after Ronald Reagan had cut taxes rather dramatically with a split Congress, Republican-Democratic Congress, he did get some credit for having cut taxes. People could see that, and as it affected them personally, Americans across the board could get some sense that maybe they had a few bucks more than they would have otherwise had. He still lost 26 seats in the House in that election, which blunted the early years of the Reagan Revolution and made it much more difficult for him in the later years of his presidency. But he at least didn't have a disaster in the Senate where they held even. And that, despite the fact that unemployment at that time in 1982 was close to 11%.
Exactly.
It was closer to 11 than 10. And that, of course, is much worse than where we are now. But people were a little more patient with Reagan. People were a little more patient in part because they were seeing more money in their paychecks. And that's not the case in the Obama situation.
Jackie.
And if I could add one more parallel of another midterm election year, 1994, it was the first midterm of President Clinton's administration. And that he had done a number of things which at the end of his term and to this day are seen as some of the major achievements of his presidency. The deficit reduction package, which helped put the nation on the path to prosperity late in his when he left office. The NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement. And those things were the public didn't want to give credit then. They weren't seeing the results yet. And so they lost control of both the House and the Senate. 2 years later, you know, you did start to see some results, and President Clinton was able to get reelected quite handily.
Jackie Combs, New York Times, Ron Elving, Washington, editor for NPR, John King, he's anchor of CNN's John King USA, chief national correspondent. And you can join us 800-433-8850. Let's move on to the issue of gay marriage and the latest ruling about same-sex marriage in California. John King, where are we?
Well, this federal judge has issued a decision that says same-sex marriages can resume next week. Now, those who want those marriages, they were lining up hoping to start them again yesterday. The judge did put a little pause in there to give opponents time to appeal. So the next step now is the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals out in San Francisco, which we will see in the next week whether they step in. Otherwise, these marriages can resume next Thursday.
So what are the possibilities here if the appeals court tosses it? Will this possibly go to the Supreme Court?
I think there's no question this issue is coming to the Supreme Court in the next year or so, whether it is this specific case that makes it first. It appears to be now. It is the case highest up in the appeal system. But this issue is coming to the Supreme Court within the next year without a doubt. And that'll be interesting because you will have two Obama appointees, one who hasn't even taken the bench yet, Elena Kagan, and Sonia Sotomayor, who in her first term was, I think, predictably left of center, but has not been involved in any cases, at least to my recollection, that you would view as trailblazing, new groundbreaking cases in the law. So this president, remember, opposes same-sex marriage, although he has said if a state wants to do it, that's up to the states. This will be an interesting legal challenge, regardless of what happens in the short term in California.
The assumption is so great that this is coming to the Supreme Court that people have already started gaming out the 9 votes on the court, and they've come down to Anthony Kennedy. And this has been going on, actually, for quite some while in California, people who have been following the Prop 8 case and the larger issue of gay marriage, so much so that some people believe that when Judge Vaughn Walker, the fellow out in San Francisco who has issued this ruling that has changed the course of this issue, when he wrote his opinion, he was actually borrowing some of the constructions, if not the actual language, of some of the opinions that Anthony Kennedy, the swing justice on the Supreme Court, has used in the past. So in a sense, he was already making a case beyond the appeals court that this will go to next, on beyond that to the ultimate decider, the Supreme Court, and specifically to the swing justice who will make the 5-4 or 4-5 go whichever way.
That's really interesting. I hadn't even heard that myself or noticed that. It's interesting that this is, again, bringing it back to this midterm election year, that this isn't a bigger issue than it is, especially we've lived through past election campaigns, 2004 presidential election year, when same-sex marriage was a big issue, and the White House, the Bush White House, actively promoted it as an issue. The Republican Party committees did. They helped get and encouraged states to put on their ballots referendum on this, and in an effort to bring out more conservative voters, and succeeded pretty well in states like Missouri and Ohio.
So when the judge says we'll just wait until next week, surely you're not going to have couples in California putting on the veils, the tuxedos, whatever, getting married next week, and then having those marriages rescinded?
Well, there are about 18,000, I believe, marriages that were done in California before Prop 8 made it illegal, during that period of time when a federal court ruling had made it legal and the time when the Prop 8 came in, or when a court ruling, I should say, had made it legal, and then when the proposition came in and made it illegal. Those 18,000 marriages, as far as the state of California is concerned, still stand. So the people who are going to get married next week, if there's no stay coming from the Court of Appeals, will presumably be as married as those previous couples. Down the road, we'll have to see what happens to that, but it does appear from the jurisprudence up to this case, up to this point, that marriages that are done legally at the time are going to be recognized as legal.
So how long could it take for the Court of Appeals to make its ruling?
Well, one would assume that the Court of Appeals will step in. I mean, obviously, they've gone for an instant appeal as quickly as possible in the six-day period that they have. So the Court of Appeals, we'll have to schedule hearings on the merits of the case, but on the basic decision of do you step up and reverse the lower judge and say, no, we're going to put a stay in place and stop the marriages from resuming, they'll make that decision within the six-day window, and then you'll have a hearing on the merits of the case. That takes a bit more time.
Well,
that's right. There are a number of people who are just basically practically keeping the champagne cold out there in California, and they were ready to go as past week, and now they're looking forward to next week. And it is possible they will be put on hold for a matter of months until the merits are heard. It's also possible it'll go ahead in the short term.
Ron Elving of NPR, John King of CNN, Jackie Combs of The New York Times. Short break, and when we come back, we'll talk about state aid and unemployment. Stay with us. And clearly there remains some confusion about this same-sex marriage decision. Here's an email from Teresa, who says, I hear many newscasts commenting that gay marriage can continue on 8/18/2010. Others have said the judge passed it to a higher court, and they will determine what to do on 8/18. Which is right, or are they both right?
In a sense, they are both right. The judge has determined it can recommence on 8/18, but he has also said, I'm pausing to give the opportunity for those who disagree with me to go to a motions panel, just three judges, to make a quickie decision as to whether or not they should be allowed to recommence on 8/18 or held in abeyance until the full reconsideration of the case by the higher court.
Okay, and we've got some relief for unemployed homeowners this week, Jackie.
The biggest disappointment for the Obama administration has been trying to, aside from the fact that unemployment remains near 10%, has been trying to get to stem the rate of foreclosures and programs that were supposed to help, several millions have helped instead several hundreds of thousands. And it's been very difficult because at the same time that some of these, subprime and even prime rate mortgages were going sour, people who were still above water were losing their jobs, and then they suddenly were also joining the ranks of the threatened homeowners. So they're trying everything, and nothing is really working. And I think, until there's fuller employment, it is going to be difficult.
Here's an email from Philip, who says, why is the Fed buying U.S. Treasury bonds? Is this normal, John King?
Normal. These are extraordinary times. It doesn't happen every day. It is one of the weapons at their disposal when they're trying to, at a time when interest rates are historically low, and when the government itself is probably not going to do any sort of big stimulus spending to prime the economy. This is one of the levers the Fed has at its disposal to try to stir things up at the same and to sort of create a more stable, friendly growth environment. However, it's one of the more modest tools they have at their disposal. And as they do it, it is a reflection of the fact that the Fed itself is divided over whether the threat is inflation or deflation, of whether it should be doing more or let the market run its course.
The people who are on the Fed Board of Governors, the Federal Reserve Board of Governors, are generally speaking not kids. They tend to be older. They tend to be somewhat more experienced in the economy. And many of them have still in their minds the great specter of inflation, and they see it as their job. They see it as their main task to make sure that inflation does not get restarted in our economy. And they see it as perhaps their task to induce a certain amount of pain. This seems to be what they see as necessary. As someone many years ago said, the job of the Fed is to take away the punch bowl just when the party gets started. That this is more important than helping the economy grow. It's more important to restrain the growth of the money supply. That's why they're there. Now, of course, there's an entirely different view of the Fed. I mean, Paul Krugman will tell you their job is to maximize employment. They should be out there trying to get the economy going. And there have been lots of other people who felt that way as well. But on the board, if you look at the people who are actually making these decisions, Ben Bernanke, the chairman, cannot just tell everybody, now we're worried about deflation, quit worrying about inflation for a while, we'll get back to that in 6 months or 5 years or whenever we need to, let's worry about getting this economy going. That's not the way a lot of these people see it.
Now, you also had a border security bill signed this week, bringing back the Senate for the first time, reconvening during August vacation since 1970. Why was that so important to do now, Jackie?
Well, in part, it was basically for technical reasons. The Senate had passed this, and then the House, which came back itself in an extraordinary session to give final passage to the bill providing state aid to the states for teachers and for public employees like first responders, also acted on this immigration funding bill, this border security funding bill. And in doing so, because a funding bill is supposed to originate in the House, the Senate had to come back and then give final approval all over again, which Democrats led by Charlie Schumer of New York were only too happy to do because they like to draw attention to the fact that they're beefing up border security because they think they cannot talk about immigration reform until the public is convinced that we're working on border security.
This is one of the – it's a fascinating debate in Washington, and it's playing out in many campaigns around the country. If you're in Arizona right now and you turn the TV on, you'll think you entered a time warp. John McCain has an ad criticizing Barack Obama. It's not about his primary opponent. It's Barack Obama versus John McCain. I think we litigated that one. In those states, it's a very emotional issue. And the administration, again, this is another issue in which they're very frustrated. They say, look at the number of Border Patrol agents. Look at the number of customs agents. Look at the crime rate along the border. And we're in a better situation statistics-wise than at any time in the Bush administration. And yet they're getting all these complaints. And they're right on those numbers. However, the sharpness of the crimes, the drug cartel violence, there's an unease in Arizona and some parts of Texas. So politically, it has some... There's a great emotion to the issue there. The interesting part, though, Diana, is see how Republicans use this issue from now through Election Day in other states, because the independents are the name of the game in a lot of these key races in the Midwest and elsewhere. And independents don't necessarily have the same views of the conservative base. A lot of Republican strategists are saying, let Senator McCain play this in Arizona. But if you're elsewhere in the country, you might not want to play this issue.
Right. Ultimately, of course, this issue hurts the Republicans among Hispanics and other new arrivals in the country. And that is something they're mindful of. I mean, this is where the growth is in the American population. overwhelmingly it's going to be people who do not belong to the McCain base. And so they really do care about elections after 2010. It's just that they care so much more about 2010 right now.
Harry Reid made a kind of strange statement this week on this very point.
He was talking to a group of people about Hispanics in Nevada and their votes, and he essentially said, well, I can't see how you could be a Hispanic and be a Republican. And that went a bit far, and a lot of people, I think, were immediately offended that he would suggest, I mean, from among other things, George W. Bush got some 40% and more of the Hispanic vote when he was running for president and did very well in Texas. Jeb Bush has done very well among Hispanics in Florida. There are lots of Hispanic Republicans. But Harry Reid was trying to make a point about where things are going in Nevada right now, and the immigration issue in particular obviously went too far.
And the White House press secretary made a little, were you there?
I was not there. I spent 8.5 years in that room, and Jackie still gets to hang out in that room a little bit. I like to go back every now. Look, the press secretary at the White House is one of the toughest jobs in Washington.
Of course.
And they spend all of their time preparing for the on-camera sparring in the briefing room. And in my experience, when a press secretary has said something that gets he or she into trouble, it often happens when they go back into their office and returning the phone calls of some print reporters, and they're not thinking, okay, what am I going to look like on camera? What am I going to say on camera? And then they say something that ends up in print, and you go, oh, my Lord. And look, this is a great frustration. They do have frustration that the left constantly says, where's the public option? Why are we in Afghanistan? You know, why didn't you pass immigration reform? Why is Gitmo still open? They do have that frustration, but they're not supposed to talk openly about it 80 days before an election.
Talk about exactly what he said, Jackie.
Well, it's, you know, the White House press secretary, the president's spokesman, is it's a first rule. You should never be in the news for yourself or what you said. It should always be – your name should appear only as behind a quotation marks that are the president's message. That was definitely off message. Now, sometimes, yeah, you do want to go out and put out a message that you don't want to have the president have ownership of. But this was not the most facile way of doing it. And I, you know, they do, this is their view that this is a professional effort. It's an inside the Beltway group. It doesn't really reflect the feelings of activists throughout the country. But it is, you know, it's uniquely Democrats do this. Republicans are far less likely to criticize, say, the president or the party in power than Democrats are. And what really frustrates the White House is that they don't, the left groups do not acknowledge just what a hurdle this White House has in dealing with the Republican obstructions of their agenda.
That's right. I think there are an awful lot of people on the left who think we've got a president we like better than any we've had in a while. We had 60% of the votes in the House and Senate for a time. They don't have that number anymore, but they were up around 60% of all the votes in the House and the Senate. And they think they've got a little D after their name. They're ours. Well, that's just not the case. An awful lot of the people in the House and Senate who have a D after their name are not what you would call liberals, and they don't follow the agenda of the people who are dissatisfied with the Obama administration from the left.
And what about those primaries on Tuesday? What did they tell us about what may happen in November, John King?
Well, I think the most striking thing they told us is yet again in Colorado with the Senate nomination and the gubernatorial nomination, they told us that Republicans are interested in changing their party in a very big way, and they're still mad at their own. Yes, Republicans are motivated to vote against the Democrats and to vote against the Obama agenda, but they're also still voicing their displeasure at all the spending and at the final few years of George W. Bush. And so when you have an establishment candidate who has any connection to Washington or any connection to a prior Republican administration, the Republican voters are saying, no, thank you, even if that candidate might be a little more controversial, might be a little bit more outside of the mainstream in the view of the punditry. They're saying, we want new voices. We want people who will go and be the bull in the china shop. And the question now is, can those candidates win in November? Or are they outside of the mainstream or inexperienced? Inexperienced candidates tend to make mistakes. And that's a fascinating dynamic. Some people think this is an accident, but it's happening state by state by state. And there seems to be a sense among Republicans that we're willing to take risks because we want something new.
Absolutely. The energy this year, everyone knows, is running in the anti-Obama direction, even as it ran in the pro-Obama direction in 2008 and to some degree in 2006 for Democrats in general. And we're really seeing this all across the board, not just in a Colorado where they went for two Tea Party favorites over two more establishment candidates who had been elected officials in the Republican Party. No question they were conservatives by a national standard. But in Colorado, the Tea Party activists preferred Ken Buck for the Senate. They preferred Dan Mays for the governorship. That's a very difficult pair of choices for them to make in terms of winning in November. It'll make it tougher for them, but they're so confident that the country is swinging back in their direction this fall, they're willing to go with those. And even in Connecticut, a completely different kind of electorate, on the other side of the country, very different demographic, you saw the Republicans preferring Linda McMahon, a first-time candidate, woman who comes from professional wrestling as a background. She was an executive of the World Wrestling Entertainment Company. And she is spending already, she's spent millions. She's talking about spending $50 million to be elected there. And she's a Republican, and she was preferred over two more standard, including a would seem to be perfectly acceptable former congressman who was running there in Connecticut. She was nominated for the Senate in Connecticut this week.
What about Sarah Palin's backing? How did that go?
Well, Sarah Palin had a mixed outing. I mean, she generally speaking, has had as her strongest suit backing candidates for governor, people who were running in primaries on the Republican side for governor, and particularly women. And she had a candidate this week in Georgia, Karen Handel. And Karen Handel had a background in the state legislature, but was not a household name throughout the state. Neither really was the other more establishment candidate, Nathan Deal, who'd been here in Congress. Now, Karen Handel was going around the state calling him a corrupt relic of Washington and many other pretty rough things. And she had Sarah Palin's very explicit backing, and she lost. She didn't lose by much. She lost by 2,500 votes statewide. It was almost too close to call, but in the end, she conceded to Nathan Deal. He'll be the Republican candidate for governor in Georgia this year. But it was so close, it's hard to really call that a defeat for either Sarah Palin or Karen Handel when they started from so far back with so few resources.
NPR's Ron Elving. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show, and we'll open the phones now, 800-433-8850. Let's go first to Joyce in Dallas, Texas. Good morning. You're on the air. Go right ahead.
Good morning. I am a small business. I'm a member of small business organizations across the country, and we're frustrated because we have jobs, but the people looking for jobs are doing it in an old, antiquated way. They're on job boards looking for the same corporate jobs they had. In small business, we've hired 65% of the workforce for the last 15 years. They must change their tactics, take more responsibility in the job, not titles. And they must be willing to take ownership of different areas of our businesses versus waiting for some manager to train them step by step, because what we need are people with experience. And as I've hired people out of large corporations, what I've recognized, because I came out of one before I started my company, was that many of them worked on very small pieces of a project, whereas as an owner of a small business, I need them to own the entire project.
John King.
It's quite an interesting perspective, because a lot of the small business community has complained about Washington, about uncertainty in the tax code. When are things going to change? We're afraid to make some hiring decisions because we're afraid this part or that part of the tax code is going to change. Here you have someone who's saying that putting a burden on those applying for jobs. I suspect if the woman gave her web address or phone number for her business right now, she would be overwhelmed, because there are a lot of people out there looking for jobs. But it is an interesting perspective on the, I guess, the quality and the flexibility of the applicant she's getting.
Joyce, thanks for calling. Let's go now to Miami, Florida. Good morning, John. You're on the air.
Good morning, Dan. I have a statement and a question, if you don't mind.
Sure.
I'm a gay man, and I'm very excited about the possibilities of marriage. My concerns stem from, beyond the emotional aspect, are the host of benefits that you get from marriage. For example, if something were to happen to me, my partner would not benefit from survivor benefits of Social Security. I'm very frustrated that President Obama, whom I voted for, has not pursued the issues as aggressively as he promised for our community. My question is also, I live in a state that where gay marriage is unconstitutional. My understanding is that the proponents, or those opposed to gay marriage, would not have standing in pursuing this case through the appeals process, because California is not pursuing the defense of Proposition 8. Can you comment on that? And one other question, if it is ultimately struck down in the Supreme Court, what does that mean for the rest of the country?
Well, on the last point, it's a key question, is what is the legal ruling? Does it end up being about the right of the voters of California to pass a proposition? That's one question. Then there's the civil rights constitutionality. Is it discrimination against same-sex couples? So there are many different issues that are part of these legal challenges, and what it will come down to when it gets to the Supreme Court on the first time they take a crack at this issue is how broad or how narrow is the decision. So we don't know the answer to some of those questions.
Here's an email from Jeff who says, is it possible the Supreme Court might decide this case is not for them?
It's conceivable. Of course, the court always has the right to deny a hearing to any case. It does not have to hear any case. It chooses not to. It can let the ruling of the last court that ruled stand. Now, in that case, that would mean the ruling of the appeals court, the Ninth Circuit Appeals Court in San Francisco, not the ruling of Judge Walker, because the court is going to review it. And unless, of course, they also have the option of saying, you know, we think Vaughn Walker just did this fine. We have no problem with the district court ruling here at all. We're just going to let it stand as written. I think that unlikely. I don't think there's much anticipation of that being the case. And even if that were the case, it would still be appealed on to the Supreme Court, at which point the Supreme Court could take it up on the basis of the last ruling that was standing then and overrule that or uphold it.
Ron Elving of NPR, Jackie Combs of the New York Times, John King of CNN. Short break, more of your calls when we come back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. By the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. And by the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world. On the web at hewlett.org. This is NPR.
The Friday News Roundup. The UN appeals for $460 million to aid flood victims in Pakistan. Insurgents are blamed for the jump in Afghan civilian casualties. And Russian fires raise nuclear fears. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And back to your comments, questions. Here's one from James in Baltimore, Maryland. Would you please comment on Dan Quayle's son's outrageous ad calling Obama, quote, the worst president in history? John King.
Ben Quayle is 33 years old. He's an attorney in the Phoenix Scottsdale area. He's running for a congressional seat. He's one of 10 Republicans in the primary. And he's recently been in a bit of hot water because he's conceded that he wrote some blog postings for a racy website that talked about Scottsdale nightlife, not exactly the kind of thing you want to be talking about if you're a family values conservative in a primary. So what has he done here? He's put a very provocative, this caller email obviously thinks it's outrageous, ad where he says that Barack Obama is the worst president in history, and that somebody needs to go to Washington essentially to kick it around and change it. If you're in a Republican district, in a Republican primary, it's a way to get attention, and it's a way to change the subject.
This is what happens when you have 10 candidates in a primary. You would think he would already have enough prominence with the name Quail and resembling his famous father. But in this case, as John says, he needs to change the tune. He has to get people some kind of a reason to talk about him other than that earlier business. You know, we were just talking about this. It's cropping up all over the place. Younger candidates who are getting into the serious business of running for public office at a high level, and folks are going back through the, shall we say, closets of their lives one way and another. They've got files and folders on the internet, and people find pictures they put on Facebook, and well, it's a cautionary tale.
Well, that's the problem. They're not closets. They are right out there in the internet.
But do voters care?
We'll know on Election Day.
Yeah. I think they care in some instances. I think if you have put yourself forward with an image of rectitude as a kind of avenging angel of morality, it doesn't help to have all of your Facebook pictures prominently
all
displayed.
All right, let's go now to Spencer, Massachusetts. Good morning, Charlie.
Good morning. I have a take on the border security problem. I think we're going at it the wrong way. Drugs are coming into the country because there is a demand for drugs. Illegal immigrants are coming into the country because there is a demand for cheap labor. If Congress would put up money to install, improve, maintain, and staff a national immigration registry, and if they would put teeth into the law, I think it's already on the book, that employers must check this registry to make sure that the people they hire are in the country legally. And if they would put a few prominent CEOs in jail, like the head of Hormel, the head of Tyson, head of Monsanto, I can almost guarantee that those jobs for illegals would dry up immediately and three-quarters of our immigration problem would be solved.
Right.
We did a story just this past week, I believe, about whether or not it would be possible in rural America to do to have a meatpacking plant somewhere in rural America and run it entirely with legal labor. I think that's not a sarcastic question. This is an absolute obvious fact that people are being drawn to this country not just by opportunity and with a capital O in some sort of Jimmy Stewart sense. They are specific jobs in specific factories, plants, farms that are being filled by people who do this for a living. They bring in the labor. They arrange for them to be legal enough to get away with it. And this is an industry. And it's much more uncomfortable to go after this industry, especially in those states where the people who benefit from that industry really are all of us, but specifically people in those states who are making a great deal of money by doing this.
Jackie.
Right, and the caller mentions he said a different perspective. It's really not a different perspective. It's just one that doesn't get the most talk about in the campaign venues, and that is that there's the demand here on the side of the border for drugs, for illegal labor force, is cheap labor force, is what's bringing people here. And he mentioned some very big and well-known corporations, but you know, for as many people as they hire, there's more hired by a raft of small businesses, including landscaping companies and restaurants. And you're talking about small business people who are pretty like sacred cows just about all over the country. I mean, everyone likes to be for the small business person. And going after them, and the federal government does and local law enforcement does to some extent, there's always... You can always say they should do more.
John.
In the state of Arizona, for example, where this debate is boiling over right now, you have the governor who signed this controversial new law. You have the Republicans and the conservative movement saying Arizona and states need rights to do this because the federal government keeps failing its test. And yet they have the E-Verify program, which is one of the things the caller talked about, where employers are supposed to take it upon themselves to verify the authenticity of these documents, whether Social Security cards and whatnot. And only about 50% of the businesses in the state are participating. And that's frustrating to many people because the caller's dead right. If there were a better job on the employer's end of policing this, you would at least deal with a part of the problem. But it doesn't happen. It's different state by state. And also, where in the national context, there's incremental steps like the one we talked about earlier where the president will sign this new law today on border security. There's no political will to get together and do what they call comprehensive, to deal with the 10 or 12 or 20 different little pieces of this very complicated puzzle.
Thanks for your call, Charlie. I do want to let listeners know this hour of the Friday News Roundup is being webcast. It will be on our website at noon, drshow.org. Let's now go to Willow Wick, Ohio. Good morning, Lance.
Good morning. As I'm listening to the conversation about all of the political issues, I'm struck and continually disappointed by how so many of the American people seem to change their views based on not a whole lot of fact, but more upon emotion or sound bites or something. I don't know what it is, and I'm wondering if the panel can comment. And the example, a couple of examples. One is, I mean, my recollection, if I'm wrong, correct me, please, is that, Barack Obama and his administration wanted actually quite a larger stimulus package, but in order to get something through, had to compromise with conservatives in both parties who refused to go along with it. And even despite the fact that many economists said that for a stimulus package to work, it had to be substantially larger. That's just one example. And I just don't quite understand the disconnect between what actually transpires and then when it comes time to vote, there seems to be a disconnect in people's thinking or attentiveness or something. I'm wondering
sure.
if you can comment on that.
Jackie.
I sympathize completely with the caller. I was thinking much along those lines yesterday as I was looking at the results from the Wall Street Journal NBC News poll, which when I previously worked for the Wall Street Journal, I was privileged to, help with over the years. Polls are snapshots in time, and which is why they're constantly changing. But in that poll, just going to the caller's point, I mentioned earlier that on issues like the economy, taxes, deficit reduction, the Democrats have lost the advantage they've had for the past few years over Republicans in who the voters see are best able to handle those issues. However, the same poll and other polls will show you that the public still blames Republicans for the shape of the economy we're in now or for the reason we got into a financial crisis in the first place. They more blame Republicans than they more blame former President George W. Bush. So you have, they're blaming the one party, but now they're saying that that same party is better able to handle the problems we have as a result. So you really, it's hard to reconcile, it seems superficially, but that's the way it is. Also, for as much of an advantage as Republicans have in this election, the Journal NBC poll shows the Republican Party's approval rating is at the lowest in the history of the Wall Street Journal NBC News poll. It's in the 20s, which is lower than the Democratic Party. And yet, the Republicans have great reason to be confident of the results in this election year.
Because they're the alternative party. And in November, if you could have perhaps a third party or a fourth party on the ballot in every race around the country to choose Congress, there would probably be a record number of votes for that third party, that fourth party, those independent candidates. And in some states, we will see that. We will see that in Colorado, the voters will have a third party option for the Senate, who is probably better known for many people in Colorado than either the Democrat or the Republican nominee for the Senate. And we will see more energy, I think, going forward on the left and on the right to try to put together parties. But for the moment, for 2010, the ballot people are going to see, in most places you're going to be asked, are you happy?
Yeah.
Check Democrat.
Yeah.
If you aren't happy,
yeah,
you're going to have one choice.
But isn't the drumbeat from the right louder than the support from the left, John King?
At the moment, yes. The drumbeat is louder and the intensity at the grassroots level is louder as the Republicans see, A, an opportunity to rebound as a party, B, an opportunity to stand up to what they believe is a too liberal Democratic / Obama agenda. Lance, Robert Gibbs could use your help dealing with the professional left in the sense that this is one of the complaints. Why isn't the president doing more to spur job growth? And the White House can rightly argue. We had some conservative Democrats, and to get three Republican votes in the Senate on the stimulus bill, we had to scale it back. So Lance is exactly right. right. However, the voters are making their decisions on the bigger issues and on the bigger feeling, their perceptions about the economy. If the Democrats can make it about this specific vote or that specific vote, they can probably help themselves in a few races here and there. But the broader dynamic is about near 10% unemployment and a funk.
Thanks for calling, Lance. Now to Sean in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Good morning.
Morning.
Go right ahead, sir.
Pardon?
Please go right ahead with your comment or question.
My question was, what exactly was the statement that was made by the White House press secretary that got him in trouble? Diane had even asked her guest what the comment was, and there was comment made about the ramifications of the statement, but the actual content of the statement was never given.
All right, let me just give you what I have, and then somebody else can comment. He made the comments to the Hill newspaper in which he suggested that, quote, the professional left should be, quote, drug tested. Anything further?
Because he said that they keep criticizing the Obama administration and what it has done. And he went on to say that, you know, some on the professional left would not be satisfied even if Dennis Kucinich, the very liberal congressman from Cleveland who ran for the Democratic nomination, if he were president. And that, you know, if we had Canadian health care or the like. And so he was venting his frustration that an administration that believes it has tried very hard to do as much as it can keeps getting criticized by these are the very people now on the left. He means the professional left. He means cable commentators and the like.
Like
but,
you,
but,
John.
But out in the grassroots, too, I would keep me in the professional center, I hope. There are some shows on cable that have been very critical of the administration,
right.
But there are also a lot of grassroots liberal activists who say, you promised to give us an immigration reform bill in the first year. You promised to close Gitmo in the first year. Why won't you stand up to the Republicans and do more on the economy? There's a frustration. It's not just in Washington. If Mr. Gibbs thinks it's just in Washington, he's mistaken.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. To Ricky in Washington, D.C., thanks for waiting. Ricky, are you there? I guess you're not. Let's go to Kalamazoo, Michigan. Good morning, Jim.
Yeah, hi, Diane. Yeah, I think we got to stop drawing lines, you know, between conservatives, liberals, and, you know, whatever the distinction is. We're all Americans, and we all have it's an American problem that right now we're facing with our economy, and we need to collectively get together on creating jobs and creating some kind of economic viability for the nation. And I think with the with our tax structure, we need to promote and perpetuate the demand. You can give money to small business, big business all day long. It won't do you a bit of good unless you have somebody coming through that door that has cash in hand to spend. You know, should we give money to business that makes ships in a bottle? Is that good tax policy? Tax policy should bring back to the individual, and for something like homes, you know, something that you can help that homeowner, give him back a little bit of his money back to him to put towards his home to perpetuate the demand in the economy. And that's
Ron Elving.
I can endorse, I think, everything Jim is saying. I think that we would all prefer an America in which partisanship was less intense, less pronounced, less what it was all about in Washington. And I think we would all prefer that we could see Congress as a bunch of individuals who had been elected because they were raised up by respectful people back in their home states and districts, and that they were then trying to work together on a reasonable basis. I actually think if you could take away a lot of the party structure and a lot of the identification and a lot of the ideological notion of who these people are, they might be a lot more reasonable human beings. We've seen that in the past, not so much today.
Let's talk about the two legendary lawmakers who died this week. John King, a former senator, Ted Stevens, died at 86 in a plane crash in Alaska. His wife also died in a plane crash.
His first wife did die in a plane crash, and Senator Stevens survived that crash. In Alaska, you know, what many of us would get on the subway or get on the highway to do in Alaska, you have to get on these small airplanes because there are no roads to a lot of the remote areas in the state. It's a horrible tragedy. Senator Stevens left under a cloud, although he was then cleared of corruption charges. And he obviously, you know, he was not in the Senate anymore. what he was. Some might think he was too big of a pork barrel spender. Some might think he was a bit of a crusty, cranky curmudgeon. He was authentic. And it is one of the things that as reporters you look for in politicians. It's not our job to say good or bad. You look for people who are who they are consistently. And he was an authentic person who loved his state and fought for it, much like the late Senator Byrd. If he could find a penny for Alaska, he was going to get it.
What about Dan Rostenkowski?
Dan Rostenkowski was another fellow who would have to be described as crusty, craggy. He was tough. He was not afraid to come on as being, in some senses, almost thuggish at times and really threatening to people. He came from the Chicago machine. His father had been an alderman, and he himself had been a baseball player, pretty good one. Played professionally for a while. He could come on pretty tough. He's also extremely smart, knew so much about the tax code, was extraordinarily sophisticated about how it all worked, and was a deal maker. And his downfall was that he felt he should be getting more reward for all those things. He always used to go on the floor of the House and say, we should all be getting paid more. If you don't want more money, I do. And in the end, he went down for charges that actually sent him to prison for 17 months of mostly petty stuff, little stuff that he was making off with furniture and things of that
nature.
Last
brief comment, Jackie.
Oh, I think Dan Rostenkowski in particular, well, both men were products of their times, the post-war generation. But they both, and especially Dan Rostenkowski in their last years, really had a sense of legacy and really did have some achievements.
Jackie Combs of the New York Times, Ron Elving of NPR, John King of CNN. Have a great weekend, everybody. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dory Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts.